This is Community Voices on NPR Illinois 91.9 UIS.
Reflection on the inauguration, a perspective from campus. The latest from NPR News is coming up in 20 minutes at the top of the hour. You can read about past Community Voices segments and listen on demand to most of them at nprillinois.org. To conclude today's Community Voices, more student questions and comments about this inauguration.
Dylan Santoni, I'm officially 2 days into Master's of Political Science program, so I look forward to seeing you all for a few more years. We've officially elected the oldest president in United States history, and there's been a hat tip towards the fact that that potentially means that Kamala Harris might be running in 4 years. But with the balance of the newly elected Senate, it launches her into kind of this high-profile role that most vice presidents don't find themselves in. What do you do if you're Kamala Harris when you may not be controlling the direction of the legislative matters as much, but yet you might be the highest profile vote for the next 4 years?
Thinking about the public and the public that for some people are super intense, but most pay attention sporadically, it's pretty much all upside. She's going to be in all the pictures. She's going to have name recognition. Starting from California helps a lot, being a senator from California, but still she is going to be the best positioned pretty much no matter what, even barring some horrendous scandal. But I think also if she ends up doing a lot of these tie-breaking votes, that's going to be give her a lot of salience. Now, how many of those there will be, I don't know. If you're a floor manager, you don't want stuff to be razor thin. You'd really rather not have to call out that tiebreaker vote. They're going to try and make legislation that gets broader support than that, but there's going to be some high profile things like the budget where she probably will cast a vote. So, I mean, it seems like it's all upside to me for her political future.
I mostly agree. I'll also just add in terms of the strategy of what actually gets voted on. I think the Democratic Party, something would have to go like drastically, drastically wrong where they put her in a position to cast the tie-breaking vote against the party or against the majority of the party, because a lot of what actually is brought to the floor in both chambers of Congress is very strategic, particularly in the House. There's this famous saying of like, if it's not supported by a majority of the majority, it's not going to make it to the floor.
I'm Eloise, and I'm a master's in political science student. I want to say welcome to Dylan. I have a question that responds to something that Dr. Transu said. Dr. Transu, you mentioned that there was a missed, I don't know, opportunity, or maybe it wasn't really an opportunity, but coming out of the Black Lives Matter protests this summer, that there really wasn't policy action that was taken. So I'm curious what you all see as the potential for that at this point, or in, you know, the coming years of this new administration?
There's different things happening at different levels. So of course, Illinois passed a relatively comprehensive bill in that area. That's just to prime the pump.
I think we're going to see possibly more criminal justice reform. I think we're going to see possibly changes in the how we view marijuana itself and what we classify it as. Whereas since states have, I already said this before, but states have already moved into legalization of marijuana, decriminalization of other drugs as well alongside marijuana. Since the war on drugs has largely impacted African-American communities and minority communities, this is the best chance in recent years that we have of freeing people who were locked up that should have never been there in the first place. That's one change that we could possibly see when it comes to criminal justice reform or a policy that could come out of the Black Lives Matter movement. Biden is a president that I believe is more reasonable when it comes to policies that hurt minority communities in comparison to Trump 100%. I think if there's anything that really could be done by a president, it could be Biden. At the same token, Biden did write the crime bill. That is a huge fact that Biden did. He did hurt minority communities in the writing of that bill. Yet in recent years, we have seen changes from Biden. We've seen him embrace Black Lives Matter, the Black Lives Matter movement. It really does depend on how much he's willing to listen and how much the Democratic Party itself in Senate is willing to listen to the voices of the people.
I'd just like to elaborate a bit upon what Transu mentioned about what happened in Illinois. And I think Illinois will be an awesome petri dish to look at what we could potentially do on a national level within the next few years. The federal government should be watching what Illinois has done and see how it goes forward, because we are in the process of ending cash bail, mandatory body cameras. So much with it was within that crime bill. And one of the most important was that it would decrease funding for those who refuse to comply, which is the stick that we really need to make sure that police officers will go forward with what we're trying to mandate. With that, I think if things go well, which I don't see why it wouldn't at this point, I think it'd be really important for the federal government to take a serious look at what Illinois did and go forward with it.
I'm Dan Wallace. I'm a MA student in political science. So good evening. Back to the polling error in 2016. And then obviously again in 2020, one of the biggest problems of 2016 was reaching and asking the right questions, right? So there a lack of questioning regarding educational attainment as it related to the pre-presidential election polling in 2016. They said they fixed that in 2020, and the polls weren't crazy off in 2020. I don't think as off as many people think they were, but they were still way off, both in the presidential election and in several key Senate races. So my question is kind of double faceted is, A, what does that mean, broadly speaking, for polling and survey research in the future? And then B, what are your takes on why the polling error was off again in 2020? In 2024, are people even going to care about polling?
After 2016, you know, the industry and academics spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out, you know, the popular vote was called fairly well, actually, in 2016, but getting the states was what did not go well. And then in 2020, in some ways, so I mean, and then one of the panaceas coming out of that as well, we just have to make sure that we weight better for education, because there's some stuff happening with educated versus less educated folks. We're not getting quality responses. And that helped, but not, you're right, not enough. I don't know that we're converging on that yet. I mean, everybody's been so, what's on Wednesday? We've had quite a string of Wednesdays. I'm hoping the next Wednesday is fairly ordinary. The main thing that I've seen thrown out so far is that it's a trust issue. The people who are not responding to surveys are lower in social trust. And how we get those folks to answer surveys again, or how we get high trust people to not answer so much, so they get down more in their population, is a hard thing. But polling is in a very difficult situation, where there was a time when we could get really good response rates face-to-face, which we still somewhat can, but face-to-face has become extremely expensive. For a while, we did well with phone, but phone really fell apart. 2008 was really the last presidential election where you could go telephone only and get decent data. The trouble with, so what we're doing now is a lot of internet-based polling. The problem there is you never really know what the true population is. The thing about face-to-face is each of us only has one body and each of us only has one vote. If you worked hard enough and kept after your sample, you can get to it. We don't know how many devices people have. We don't know how many filters they're going through. The industry has shifted to what we call opt-in polls. When you see in the internet, when you're around and some pop-up will say, enter here, win a free iPad. A lot of those things are intakes, trying to gather emails, and then those people are asked to join an online panel. Well, how do we get from the people who are online to everybody? We try to do that by waiting. We're still in flux. So as to why people will believe them in 2024, we're not really thrilled with so much of it being day-to-day horse race, because that's not really what polls are best at anyway. Who knows what's going to happen? But again, a lot of this stuff comes through these unshared realities. And I think there's one thing that we haven't mentioned as much in this discussion, and that is, it's a bit like social class, but the advantage for having at least a bachelor's degree, I mean, that's one of the huge schisms in our country now, where not only in this kind of voting stuff crisis not that long ago was the opiate addiction crisis that was hitting people without a BA much, much harder than college educated folks. We've lost some connections that we need to rebuild.
I'm Amanda. I'm a communications major. I have family members that disagree on a lot of things that I, like the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. Where does the division come from in like people? Is it a result of the media or education? I'm just trying to get a better idea of where like people differentiate in their political views.
You're asking, where does the division come in like people?
I know a lot of good people who don't really meet eye to eye with me on like certain things that I believe are what all good people should, like the Black Lives Matter movement.
I grew up in a predominantly white community. I've had firsthand the racism, but I also know that there are very good people out in this world. I also know that as long as there are two people on this earth, there's going to be one that does not agree or does not associate or like the other person. And I think that comes from us being within ourselves and us knowing, you know, who we are and knowing right from wrong. When it comes to certain issues, you know, in this nation or just about in general, there is a right and wrong. Not all issues are black and white. And sometimes it literally just takes putting yourself in other people's shoes. Not a lot of people do that. And that's like one of the main things where you can see. So even though if you're strong about an issue, sometimes I'm strong about an issue and I know that I'm right, or I think that I know that I'm right. But sometimes I have to take a step back and put myself in the other person's shoes and try to see what angle they're coming from to see if I can change that angle and try to shift it to another angle. And a lot of people just do not want to have the tough conversations. They would rather hide behind a keyboard or not educate themselves or try to think their way is the only way. And that just comes with communication and kind of saying, hey, we are at a disagreement, but I do want to understand where you're coming from. It's just an understanding and also self-education. People will see a headline on a media and they will run with that instead of going in and diving and doing some supplementary research and saying like, oh, even though the headline said this, it actually meant this and these numbers or this subject or this is actually embedded within the article, but I only saw the headline and that's what I ran with. And that's where you see a lot of people arguing on social media and divisions happening with that, or even in policy with legislators and, you know, senators, they're bickering back and forth between the aisle, but they're not actually listening or trying to understand one another. I would say self-education. I would say putting yourself in other people's shoes. And I would just say trying to understand where that person is coming from and seeing. And sometimes at the end of the day, you'll have to agree to disagree. That's what it is.
When a big major issue with education, I think, is how we educate people and like what issues we tend to focus and what details we tend to ignore. Issues such as racism in this country, issues such as topics on the Civil War and slavery are a big thing. Allowing for like these gaps in like the explicit details, I think, allows for people to fall into rabbit holes on social media a lot easier. Whether it be a rabbit hole into, you know, the alt-right, or whether it be a rabbit hole into more leftist ideologies. It's a big issue of just trying to find out what are the facts people need to realize and focus on. Since it's very easy to click on a YouTube video and then the YouTube algorithm is going to show you the same video or from similar creators. And then that just feeds you into more into one ideology. And the more further down you go, the harder it is to get out and, you know, re-educate yourselves into thinking, hey, these stereotypes are not true. The people who are stealing my jobs are not Mexicans, they're not Hispanic, they're not immigrants. This caravan that's coming into the country, it's full of, you know, illegals, it's full of criminals, rapists, drug dealers. It's hard to get yourself out of that mentality because you already have that set into your mind. Once you do educate yourselves, once you do get an understanding of, hey, this is actually not true. These are the facts. The fact is these jobs are being outsourced into like other countries. There's other kinds of issues going into the economy right now. It really is a sole focus on education and what we deem as news and not fake news.
I completely get what you're asking, that it's just like you think there's these really awesome people you have in your life and that you think they're really great. And then you hear like all lives matter. And then you pause for a moment and you have to think, what the heck just happened? I've seen it a lot in my own life. I'm a extremely white passing Latina. Like when you look at me, you wouldn't even notice it. So half of my family members are Black and brown. And then the other half is extremely rural white people. You grow up with these people and you just don't fully understand why they can't get what you're talking about. And I think a really important reason for that is that they're used to these white power structures that we've had in our day-to-day lives since essentially forever. And then we have a movement that comes forward that tries to poke the holes in what's going on and show exactly where we've gone wrong and how we're hurting people. And they're not used to it because they've never personally been affected by it. So I think what's important for white people and white passing people is that from here on out, we need to come forward and say and educate our white friends and family and people who say that and say that this isn't okay, but let me show you why it's not okay. Because if you just say it's not okay, they can just put that in the back of their head and say, yeah, sure, and then never think about it again. Over time, we need to start working with these people and breaking it down and showing them how we are hurting other people that we care about. And hopefully from there forward, they can start to understand why when you say Black Lives Matter, that doesn't mean all lives don't matter. It's something that's going to take time and it's extremely frustrating. I know firsthand. I've had some breakthroughs on my own with some of my white family members, and I hope that that can happen with everyone else here over time.
Mackenzie Matthews suggesting, although difficult, how to stop the damage of racism. Thank you to the UIS Political Science Department and the Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs Office for producing this event and making the audio available to us. We wanted to make sure you didn't miss the conversation. The panel featured political science faculty Dr. Matthew Garris and Dr. John Transu, alumnus and Illinois legislative liaison Joe McGee, student government parliamentarian Mackenzie Matthews, and political science and global studies major Francisco Lopez Zavala. You can read about past Community Voices segments and listen on demand to most of them at nprillinois.org. Suggest a guest. Email communityvoices@nprillinois.org and we'll explore interviewing them. Community Voices airs weekdays at noon and Saturdays at 5 p.m. on NPR Illinois, 91.9 UIS. For B. Bonner, I'm Randy Eccles. Community Voices is a production of NPR Illinois.